So at least there's an audio record of it. So now I've just started recording it. So now the recording starts now. Hello, everyone watching, listening to the Comp 2406 first lecture. I started a little late. I'm sorry. So there's four assignments, the tutorials, midterm, and final exam. If you want to find out what you're in for this term, if you look on my wiki, past runs of this course, in particular the past run last term, is on my wiki. All the assignments, all the solutions, midterm and final, feel free to look at them. Expect significant amounts of material reuse. I don't care if you look at that stuff. I actually want you to look at that stuff. And the reason I want you to look at that stuff is because I want you to learn the material. That's the way this whole course is designed. In particular, you're going to learn to read JavaScript. It's a language most of you do not know, and even if you think you know it, you probably don't know it. If you are cutting and pasting JavaScript into web pages and you think, oh, I can kind of do this, like, you don't understand JavaScript. So, use the material, you got assignments, you got the tutorial, midterm, final, otherwise pretty simple. We have five TAs. Annie, I just pointed out. Andrew is not here right now. Dave, he might be here. I'm not sure. So Furkan and Michael. I'm just looking to see. It's hard to find anyone in this classroom. But anyway, so five TAs. You'll be meeting them a lot in the tutorials because they will be there. You should also plan on coming through office hours for help. Don't get behind. Don't get behind in this class, because if you get behind, everything is cumulative. Which means, when I say cumulative, it's not to say that I'm going to be testing you basically. It's just that you're learning a complex software environment. And we're going to get more and more into the complexities of it. So if you miss the basics, getting the more advanced parts will be much, much harder. So communication, the wiki is where you want to go. You'll be submitting assignments through CU Learn. It's already created there. You won't find much material in CU Learn. Just expect to be going there to submit assignments. And also, I will post messages there, and I'll set up a discussion forum if you want to discuss things related to the course. Feel free. If you ever want to edit this wiki, I'm happy to give you an account. I'm expecting most of you won't want to edit stuff, but like, you want to help fix make little corrections or something, go right ahead. If you decide to deface the wiki, I know I have your email address. I know who you are. It's a blow thing with wiki, so yeah. Collaboration. You may collaborate. Please collaborate. The only thing I ask is that if you first off, anything you submit should be your own. Don't be submitting, don't work with someone else, let them do the work and then you submit the work. You need to submit your own work. But it's perfectly fine to work with others on your assignments. Perfectly fine to work with others during the tutorials. Help each other out. Because there's some stuff to learn here. One basic way to make sure you actually learn the material and turn your own work is don't share files of code. Don't do it. Talk about the code. Look at your friend's code. Well, fine. But when it comes to actually making your solution, write your own code. Because that way you'll actually understand it. And trust me, this is what you want to do. Because the thing that will matter the most is when you go to the midterm and final and actually have to answer questions about it. So, texts. So, like last term, I have two required texts. These are all books that are published by O'Reilly. I don't know if you all know O'Reilly as a publisher. If you in computer science, you should. What I like about O'Reilly books is I can almost always recommend one of their books saying, it's going to be a pretty good book. It might not be the exact best, but it's going to be pretty good. And these are all, basically the best ones I could find on these materials. So This should give you an idea of the material you're going to be covering. First off, JavaScript. Then you're going to be learning this thing called Node, which is built on top of JavaScript, which I'll explain to you what it is in a little bit. And then also, I would suggest that you get the MongoDB guide. You don't have to, but it potentially may help you. But I definitely noticed last term that MongoDB is there. Now, I believe I've asked the bookstore to get all these books. Are all three of them in there? Have you?
The last one is on back order right now.
Ah, okay. The last one's in back order. Okay, that's fine. But the other two, again, this one you'll only need later, and you won't strictly need this, but these two. And also, everything's available in electronic form. You can get them directly from O'Reilly. What's really great is when they make them available in many forms without any DRM. So you're going to use it on whatever device you want. In fact, I generally keep it on my phone. So course software. So for this class, you're going to be developing web applications. So one thing, of course, you need is a web browser, but you also need to run the web application somewhere. So the easiest teaching environment I've had for this is using a Linux virtual machine where you'll run the server there locally and you'll access the web browser all in one VM. Now, this development environment, you can use all the stuff we build, you can use it, deploy it to the cloud, and I will try to show you how to do that at some point in this class. I didn't do this last term. But you can deploy it to Amazon, deploy it to Azure or something, and run your web application there and it'll run basically the same as it does in your virtual machine. Now, these VMs are in the SCS labs. We'll be using them in the SCS labs, but also you probably want to set them up on your own systems. So here is an OVA. What does that stand for? Basically, it's a virtual appliance. So download this to your machine, install VirtualBox. If you install VirtualBox, you'll be able to import this and get a virtual machine running in your box, and it'll work fine. If you want to use VMware, you all know you have free licenses for VMware.
Hmm? There should be a little handle to pull it out on the right. I'm not seeing it on that right.
Oh, this?
Yes.
Okay.
That.
There is a drawer.
I didn't realize there was a drawer there. Okay.
Okay, let's. Oh, okay, I gotta take. I have to move my Fitbit. Here. Now let's see if I can get this working.
This is on.
Hello? How's that? Okay, I better wear collared shirts all the time. Okay, is that any better? Should I turn it up? Okay. So what I was saying is, so for this class, you're going to be using a Linux virtual machine. The particular Linux distribution we'll be using is Lubuntu, which is a low resource variant of Ubuntu. Feel free to use another Linux distribution on your system. If you already have Linux running in your system, it's not very hard to get the software we're going to be using running on it. Now, all of the stuff we're using is actually cross-platform. So you could install all the stuff natively on macOS or on Windows. I do not recommend this because there are little glitches. There are just little glitches which you can get around if you want to, but it will cause you pain. And unless you like dealing with that sort of pain, don't do it. Stick with a virtual machine. So you can download this appliance under your machine, import it into VirtualBox or VMware. Oh, that's what I was saying. We have free licenses for VMware for all students in computer science. You know, you go to the SCS support page, they've got a link to it, and you can download it for your machines. They even have it, they have VMware Workstation, and they have VMware Fusion. So if you ever use the VMware products, they're quite nice. So, but if you're going to use this, I've done it for VirtualBox, you'll have to convert it over to being a VMware thing, but it's not very hard. But if you're, but one problem with running things in a virtual machine, especially running in the lab, is all the soft, all the work you do is stuck inside that virtual machine. And in particular, when you log out, it's gone. It all disappears. So if you want that information to be persistent, I have put scripts into the virtual machine to allow you to save everything in your home directory. You'll be logging in as the student user. Everything in that you can sync to the SCS servers. Basically, there's a script called save 2406, restore 2406, compare. We'll play with this in tutorials, so you'll see how these work, but I'm just telling you, you get your virtual machine running, you have your virtual machine running at home, you could run the save script, it'll save it to the SCS servers, you go into the labs, and you do the restore, and you can use it there. And it's the same environment then. So I encourage you to do that, and then similarly, when you do it at home, you know, do it in the lab, sync it, restore it from home. So you can use, have multiple copies of your virtual machine. This lets you sync it up. You don't have to worry about things. As a security, so my area of research is security. So as a security person, I normally recommend people to go ahead and update the software inside the virtual machine. You may not want to do that because every time you go into the lab, the image is going to be the same. So it will ask you every time to update it to the latest version. And so then you'll be running different versions, potentially, especially of Node. So just ignore it. Just use the same version. I mean, this is just an isolated VM anyway. And I just updated it. It should be good for the next couple of months. So use that. So I just wanted to, so logistics, there's a lot of stuff here on learning JavaScript and Node. Here's the lecture schedule. This is where I get all the lecture notes. So one thing I am willing to offer, I haven't put this on the outline, but I can do this, is I would like some people to help take notes in the wiki. If you are willing to, if you do a proper lecture editing, I will add potentially 2 percentage marks to your final grade. So it's kind of like basically an extra credit, but you have to do a good job doing notes for a lecture. There's more than enough people here, so basically there's 22 opportunities for extra credit. If more than 22 people want to do this, we can find some way of sharing it or whatever. But if you want to take notes, let me know. If you're taking notes for this class, for this particular lecture, let me know. Although I don't really see the point in most of the stuff I'm saying, for today at least. Any kind of logistics questions? Yes? Almost. So let me show you the tutorials here. So each week you'll get a progress grade from 0 to 4, given by a TA or me in the tutorial. It depends on the tutorial. For a lot of tutorials, if you just show up and do stuff, you'll get 4. So as the term goes on, we'll be expecting more of you, that you'll actually have to have shown that you can get something running to get the 4 marks, but basically, if you go in there and do the work, you should be able to get a 4, unless you're behind. If it turns out that you start, you're not keeping up with the material, that means you'll come in a tutorial and you won't be able to do what we expect. If you start getting less than 4, it means you're behind. So, participation, mostly. I need to figure out, I need to give you some motivation to actually do some work as opposed to just sit there and surf the web while you're sitting in tutorial. Good. So, yes? Okay. I'm actually very interested in looking for adding things here. So in a kind of a traditional course, a lot of times people are saying, oh, there's all this stuff online, I don't want you to look at it or anything, and that's all separate. It's like, this course is exactly the opposite. I want you to learn whatever you can from whatever online resources you can. And if you find really good ones, I will add links here. I actually don't have any good resources here for learning MongoDB. So if you could email that to me, I'd be happy to add that here. So I want to have lots of resources because The thing about web technologies is they move really fast, and learn it whatever way you want. And I think you coming to lectures will potentially help you learn things. I think you coming to tutorials will help you learn things, but really, I just care about you learning it. And if you want to learn a lot of stuff on your own, but I will tell you, if you just go off on your own and learn stuff, you probably won't learn some of the nuances I'm trying to teach you. So, yes? You could, but right now it's designed to save the entire home directory to SES, so it's probably not what you want. But you could tweak, I'm sure you could tweak it so that, I mean, it's just an bash alias. That's all it is. It's like a one-line bash alias which runs rsync. So one thing to warn you about the save and restore scripts is they clobber the destination. So if you run restore, it erases everything in your home directory. If you're in a virtual machine, that doesn't normally matter, but just realize it's going to make it match up the destination. Yes? Mm-hmm. Well, and basically why I've got it right here. It's like install Node, install MongoDB, have an editor. That's basically, we're using Node, you need a web browser, and you need MongoDB running. That's the development environment. Otherwise, I'll be giving you, here's a web app, run this. So again, yeah, you can certainly, I mean, I don't use the VM most of the time when I'm doing development for the course. I maybe check it, but I have a standard Ubuntu distribution that I'm running. Watching the machine that's hosting this wiki, in fact, is where I do a lot of stuff. So. You may bring your laptops to the labs and do your work on them. That is perfectly fine. The only thing, if you do that, actually, that's fine. Just come to the labs and do that. But you should come to the labs. And the reason why I want you to come to the tutorials with the TAs and stuff there is because I've seen so many occasions where people get stuck on one stupid little part of things. And once you get past that, then everything else is easy. And so by having you come in regularly, I can first of all learn what you're messing up with, what you're not getting confused by, and you all can get past the bumps. Basically, once you do the tutorials, the assignments are much, much easier. Other questions? So in that case, I might as well. Okay, good. Only half an hour. Yes? No. Okay, I didn't explain that. So if you look at the tutorial schedule, I have the date set up like this. So it's Thursday, Friday, Monday. The week for the tutorial purposes starts on Thursday. Because if you just look at the way things are, it just seemed like it would make more sense that way. So just start going to tutorials on Thursday. Monday, you're getting the same thing. So there's unfortunately a lecture in the middle of the tutorials, but yes? The midterm right now is set for the day before winter break, Valentine's Day, Friday. So yes, I know that's not a fun date necessarily, but I can't really push it back any further. I can push it to after winter break, but I'm reluctant to do that because I suspect that will hurt most of you because you're not going to do that much studying over winter break. I suspect. I know there's this thing, it's a reading week and people go off, but I'm guessing a lot of you are going to go do other things. And that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. But that's why it's like, if I have it this way, you finish the midterm, you're done. You have no assignments due. You have no midterm thing. You go away. You come back, and then we start afresh. Yes.
Can we potentially leave it where it is? Because if you move it to the next day,
Yeah. So this is, again, one thing I wanted to find out is how much am I conflicting with other courses? I don't know exactly which courses you all are taking. It's especially hard for this course because sometimes it seems like I get people taking second, third, and fourth year taking this course. So I can't figure out what conflicts. So you have to let me know if I'm like stepping on some major dates. And I'm willing to tweak things, but... And the one thing to know, like, for example, so with the midterm here on Friday, the assignment two is due on the Wednesday. And so on that Wednesday, as part of the review, I will go over the solutions for the assignment. So I can't really extend the deadline for that assignment date because I'll be going over the solutions. Right? Other quick questions? Maybe not so quick. Okay. Oh, yes. So again, I just say collaboration's fine, but don't turn in some of this work. I'm generally not seeing much of a problem with plagiarism in this class because I want you to really work together. But if you start turning in code that's identical to other people's code, we might have to start checking for that, and that will be very annoying, and don't do that. And when you're taking a test, don't look at other people's answers. But yeah, you knew that. Yes. Since I've got the other thing, let me just show you what is in mind for your past things, because it will be, that's not what I want, fall 2013. So let me just show you the final exam in case you're curious. This is what the old, so you see some true and false there. And then what you're actually doing is you are looking at the behavior of, So you got short answers here, and what you're actually doing is you're discussing how this code works. So the basic thing which I did last term, which I really liked, is basically I give you a complete web application on the midterm and final, and you have to tell me how it works. If I delete a line, what does it do? If I make this change, I could have this where, okay, implement this function, write it out. But no, I don't want you so much to write code. I want you to read code. I want you to tell me, it's like, there are six calls to methods defined by the Mongoose module. What are these six and what does each do? So like, explain to me those lines, explain to me these. So not multiple choice. And particularly for a class this size, multiple choice is certainly appealing. I will admit it's appealing, but the problem with multiple choice I have as an educator is it's all about recognition. It means you just look at the four or five choices, and if you recognize the answer, you do it. Now maybe you have to work out something, maybe you can put things to distract you or something, but it's an entirely different level of understanding, I find, to answer a multiple choice question versus having to really explain it in your own words. And I find that also for debugging people's answers, for seeing what do you understand and what do you not understand, I get a lot more out of your full written responses. So it's definitely more painful to grade, but I think it's a better educational tool, and also find that I think people actually learn things from having done the midterm or final. Okay? But yeah, you're going to be writing. Keep up with that. There is no group project. So in the first run of this class, I take that back. There is an optional project. And that project is specifically for those of you who look at this and go like, this is easy. If you're looking at if you're going through the first half of the term and you're going like, this is all easy, I've already done all kinds of web development, I'm starting to snore, during things, you can do a project. And that project can be in collaboration with others. And what that means is you use the technologies we go through in class and build me a nice web application. And if you build me a nice web application, you can skip the last two assignments and turn that in instead of the assignments. But what that means is that is going to, I expect more work from you, well, more sophisticated work than if you're just doing the assignments. Right? This is not a solution if you're getting behind in the assignments to the project. No. This is, you need to do something interesting to stay motivated for the class. I know there are those of you out there who, if I just do the assignment's too easy, rather than do the easy assignment, you won't turn the assignment in. That happens. For those of you, that's who the project is for. The rest of you, forget about it. Okay, I mean, okay, so now you have now, again, there's lots of material from last term, but it will change. In particular, like the schedule of the tutorials will change, not the dates, but the material exactly covered. I realize this term, I think I want to cover web workers, and I want to do more with MongoDB, some database side JavaScript. I've got some fun ideas. We'll see how it works out. But anything else? So otherwise, I want to talk about web applications. So for those, most of you probably don't know this, but I'm very involved in curriculum changes in computer science. And as part of that, I pushed to get this course created, and of course, since I pushed to have this course created, I had to teach it. That's what happens, you know, when you volunteer for something. But I don't consider this a bad thing. The reason why I pushed for this course was because I looked at what is programming in the real world. And I realized programming in the real world today is more and more web apps. It's just web technology. The web stack is what we build, one way or the other. If you build something that's not part of the web stack, it gets connected to the web stack. You know, you're going to build a game. Oh, that doesn't involve the web. Oh, wait, you want to make it multiplayer. Oh, wait, you want leaderboards or something. What's the technology you're going to build for that? It's going to be web technology. You want to, anything you build is going to probably connect to the web in some silly way. It may be a major part of it, it may be a minor part, but you've got to understand this. And our entire curriculum had nothing about that as a required part of the course. Thus, this course is required saying, okay, now you're going to learn about this stuff. But one of the things that I got pushback from proposing this course, they're going, how are you going to do that? There's too much there. And if you've tried doing anything with web stuff, you might have heard a lot of different buzzwords. I mean, what are we talking about here? We're talking about things like, first of all, HTML.
Sure.
Talk about CSS, right? We've got JavaScript. Oh, right, and there's this Java seems to be important for some of this stuff. PHP, Ruby, on Rails. Some people use Python. You got ASP.NET. Might have heard of CoffeeScript. I mean, I could just sit here and spend, you know, my entire day listing acronyms and names of technologies that are related to the web. I can't cover all the stuff. It's impossible. The good news is this is a fundamentals course, so I don't have to. So the question is, where are the fundamentals? Where does that sit? What is the key set of technologies, the key set of concepts that you need to understand in order to understand what a web application is? Oh, CGI. So traditionally, courses like this, our old 24/5, would often focus on HTML, would focus on CSS, would focus on CGI. Maybe they would teach Perl. That's the sort of thing they would teach as a web class. That's not really what I'm going to cover in this class. There will be some CSS, there will be some HTML, but I'm going to mostly try to keep away from that and mostly let you learn that on your own. Because I consider you all to be bright computer science people. You can learn stuff on your own. And markup languages, if you know any programming, a markup language is something you should be able to get. A language for describing layouts is something you should basically be able to figure out. There's lots of online resources for learning a lot of this stuff. Use it. You won't need to go through it. Now, I will cover some of it, but this is not the hard part. I mean, to do this really well, I mean, you can spend years mastering these technologies. And there's lots of really sophisticated stuff by there. But I'm concerned more with not to become an expert web graphic designer. I want you to understand what's the underlying technology of making it an application. And so here I'm distinguishing between the web as something for serving documents and the web as something for running programs. The web was originally built to serve documents. Today, it's used to run programs. And that's what I want to teach is those programs, what they look like. And so the focus of this class is fundamentally on JavaScript. Didn't mention any of the backend stuff. So we're going to talk about this in a couple of different forms, but the idea is to really learn this as a language and as a technology that fits in on both the client, the server, and the backend database. Now, JavaScript is the language of the browser. This is the language you'd use to add code to a web page. Normally, if I'm writing a web application, I would need a language to program the web browser, and I need a language to program the web server. And that language has traditionally been things like Java, or PHP, or Ruby, or Perl, or whatever. For this class, the language we're going to use on the server is JavaScript. JavaScript on the client, JavaScript on the server. Now you might go, what? Isn't JavaScript this really bad language? Why would I want to program anything on the server? And isn't it really slow? Well, no, on both counts. JavaScript does have an unfortunate feature that it was kind of created in about 10 days. And it shows. I see JavaScript as the first draft of an amazing language. If you want to find out what the final version should have been, look at something like Lua. Lua is a very pretty language. I actually like it a lot. I'm not going to cover Lua in this class because it's not that many places. Certainly not in the web stack. JavaScript is. So JavaScript's got certain very deep programming language concepts that somehow managed to get in there, which I'm kind of shocked that it actually got in there. But it makes it very, very powerful and very different from most of the other languages you've used. Unless you've used languages like Lisp. If you're familiar with Lisp, Scheme, closures, things like that, that's actually what JavaScript is. JavaScript is Lisp in C syntax. So now for most of you, you're kind of going like, Lisp, if you've heard of it, you might not know much about it. For those of you who might have heard a little bit about it, it's this programming language that was developed for artificial intelligence in the 1950s, I think like 1958. And it was one of the first programming languages developed that's still in use. Like the first one is Fortran, and then comes Lisp. Maybe COBOL's soon around there too, but I'll just tell you, Lisp is amazing. Lisp has lots of parentheses, so a lot of people get scared of Lisp. So we have JavaScript. Not so many parentheses, more C-like code, but the same conceptual model underneath it, with a few modern additions. JavaScript is object-oriented, but it's object-oriented in a way that you're not familiar with. There are no classes in JavaScript. And as you'll come to understand, there is a reason why there are no classes in JavaScript, because they don't make sense in its execution model. There are instead prototypes. So you can do inheritance, but it's different. So I'm going to cover JavaScript. It's an amazing technology. It's got certain warts. You're going to have to get, you know, figure out how to get around some of them. But if you learn the right subset, that's what that book, JavaScript, The Good Parts, is about. It's telling you about how to program JavaScript as a nice language. By saying, use these features, ignore those other ones. And those other ones, just don't pay attention to. But JavaScript on the server, JavaScript on the client. So how do I run JavaScript on the server? The way you run it is running something called node.js or node. What node is it takes the JavaScript engine from the Chrome web browser, something known as V8, and sticks it into the web server. So it gets rid of all the stuff for managing web pages and instead adds in lots of libraries for doing local I/O and doing networking and stuff. Turns out that by default, JavaScript can't do file I/O the way you're used to. It doesn't have an open, read, write. Those things don't exist as part of the standard JavaScript spec. That actually turned out to be a good thing for the development of Node, because it allowed them to build in new ones. And the new ones are kind of like what you're used to, except for one big change. They're asynchronous. And that's the other big thing. When you're learning JavaScript, you'll be learning about asynchronous program design. And this is another key part of understanding web applications. If you think of a program as, oh, you start the program, it does this, it does this, it does this, it does this, and then it quits. That's not the control flow of a web application at all. A web server sits there and gets a request, handles a request, sends it back. The web application, you know, in the web browser is saying they're running, sending requests, waiting for responses, getting them back, waiting for user input, handling it, sending something to the network. It's this event-driven, asynchronous kind of design. And so now I have to explain, what do I mean by asynchronous? Well, the easiest way to understand asynchronous is to understand what synchronous is. So synchronous means it's coordinated. Something that has to, if there's some next thing to happen, something has to have finished. So let's say I want you all to write something on a piece of paper. I want you to write a word. So to do it synchronously, I would tell you all, everyone, write the letter H. So now you all write the letter H. And I wait for you to write the letter H. And say, everyone done with letter H? Raise your hand, everyone done? Okay. Then I say, now write E. And I wait for you to finish that. And once everyone's done, that's synchronous. Asynchronous is me saying, write the word hello, then write the world, then write the word world. When you're done, you can leave the class. That would be asynchronous. Because there I'm not coordinating the actions of somebody. Some of you would take a long time to write hello world, because maybe you just don't like writing with a pencil. Or maybe you didn't bring one. That'll make it really challenging. So you're sitting there, you have to write, and so you. But others of you will have it already. You've already taken notes, you write hello world, and then you leave. When you write a program asynchronously, you're writing something where you're inherently parallel, things are going on behind your back, and you respond to events. You, when a condition is met, then another thing happens. Like once you've written that condition of, oh, you've finished the task, oh, now you go on to the next task. That's how we'll be building programs. That's how JavaScript works as a language. And it works that way in the browser, and it also works that way on the server. Because it's all about when something finishes, you finish with that, and then you move on to the next task. But you don't move on to the next, you wait for the next thing that's pending. There's a constant event loop that's waiting for stuff. So that's what I'm gonna cover. But now there's one little problem with this. So I've got a missing piece. A web application consists of three things typically. There's the browser, there's the server, then there's the database. So now the question in the class is, well, what database would I cover? I could cover the full databases that are used in web applications, typically they're SQL based. But if I teach you that, then I have to teach you SQL and full relational databases. There's an entire class in our curriculum devoted to databases. There's a lot of stuff to learn with databases. I don't want to have to cover everything. So that's why we're going to learn something called MongoDB. If you look on the web and you start looking at stuff, you might even find some not so polite videos about MongoDB and about how it's web scale or not. But it's a database. But it's a database of the genre known as NoSQL databases. And what really NoSQL means is they just don't support all the semantics of SQL. They might go, well, why do I care about that? Well, there's this thing called transactions. And transactions are useful for a lot of things, particularly for certain kinds of e-commerce applications, or there are systems where you really want this. And we will talk about the systems where you really want this. But a lot of systems, you don't want this. And it turns out the cost for things like transactions is very high in terms of performance. And that's why people started creating these NoSQL type databases. For this class, the nice thing about MongoDB is not so much that it really scales, but the fact that it serves JavaScript. You can program the server in JavaScript, and what it stores are things known as, it's something very close to JSON. JSON is the normal language now that is used for code in your browser and code in the web server to talk to each other. JSON stands for JavaScript Object Notation. In other words, it's just JavaScript, a subset of JavaScript. It's the object notation of JavaScript. So, by covering MongoDB, by using Node on the server and stuff, everything becomes related to JavaScript. What we're storing in our backend database now is just JavaScript objects. Our server is running JavaScript, the same data structure then can also run in the client. This is how I'm able to fit everything I want to fit into one semester and actually cover some depth of the material with what it is for a web application. Now, I'm not expecting, this is the really high 10,000 feet overview of this stuff. This is as much to give you a map of where we're going for the term. So the way things are going to work is this lecture is all about trying to give you the connect the pieces. The tutorials are where you're going to go play with the technology. I will typically give you a web application to run in lab. You will play with it, and you'll have to modify it. And the only way you'll be able to modify it is you'll actually have to have a clue about how it works. And that's how you learn. And then you'll do an assignment, and for the assignment, you'll have to do more modifications, or you'll have to answer some questions about the web applications we built. The web applications built in Node. And then the test, you answer questions about it. So now after having talked about this low level stuff, I want to step back and say, what is the web? And what, and in particular, what's the scale at which the web works? Does anyone know how many computers Google has now? How many servers it runs? No. How many they exactly have is actually kind of a trade secret they don't tell people. But there are various estimates out there for how much. I mean, of course, it keeps growing, but anyone have an idea? Some guesses? Yes? So what? 450,000? I think that was probably that about 4 or 5 years ago. It's about 2 million, I think, now, at least. 2 million computers. At least. Maybe more. You're talking about services like Facebook?
You're not talking about 2 million, but talking about, I think, hundreds of thousands at this point. Major corporations typically run like tens of thousands, but now you're getting into the, you know, 100,000 order magnitude million machine. I mean, you should be going like, wow, that's a lot of machines. And next off, you should be thinking, holy cow, how do you program that many machines? How do I do that? What, you know, what's the, how do I coordinate all that material? You know, if you've ever tried just doing any sort of parallel stuff, like having just what two things coordinated, going like, okay, that's hard. A million machines? How do you do that? On an environmental side, you should also realize, wow, that's a lot of electricity. So, I don't know if you've, some of you may have kept track of where these data centers are being built. The way modern data centers are built is they're built where the building block is like a container, as in the back of a semi. They take that and arrange the computers, and that becomes a unit of computing, and they stack those in order to make a data center. And then say, where do you want to stack them? Stack them near some place you have cheap, reliable power. The kind of place they used to build aluminum smelters. But instead of an aluminum smelter, let's use that electricity to do likes. That's what the modern web industry, it's the modern heavy industry. Computation is a heavy industry. It uses enormous amounts of resources. That's an interesting political, social, economic phenomenon. But here we're more concerned with the technological aspects of that, which is, how in the world do you build systems of that scale? How do you build systems? So how many lines of code do you think run on these things? Well, first off, how many lines of code are in Windows? Actually, more than like that. How many lines of code are in the Linux kernel? Anyone know? Roughly. It's about 15 million. Windows is order 100 million. Major browsers are on the order of 5 million. Lines of code. So I feel that when you get to systems that have at least a million lines of code, there's a major discontinuity, because you get into the realm where the code base is literally not humanly comprehensible. The largest novels in English, like things like War and Peace, are around 100,000 words. These are an order of magnitude more complex than the largest novels. How does any person keep all those details in their brain? They don't. We're building systems of such large amounts of code running on so many machines, nobody understands how these systems are built. So how do you build a system that you don't understand? This should kind of be setting up some alarm bells and any kind of ideas you have about software engineering. Aren't we supposed to design software? How do you design something that you don't understand? Well, the news is you don't. None of these systems are actually designed. Nobody designed Google.
Nobody designed Facebook. Nobody designed Windows. They evolved over time. That means that they started as small, simple programs that mere mortals could understand. But then stuff got added on. And more stuff got added on. And more stuff got added on. And it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until you got this giant edifice that no one understands. That is the web. Now, what I regard as almost the miracle of the web is that it's one thing to do this on one machine where it's all kind of crazy, but we managed to do this for systems that run across thousands of machines. And somehow the web allowed us to do this. And this is really interesting if you look at the history of parallel systems, because back in the 1980s, they would really get excited about systems that would run on like 10 computers. They're going like, wow, that's really big scale. I'm running on 10 computers. And now that's like barely a footnote. It's like, why was it so hard to build on 10 systems before? And now we're talking about tens of thousands of systems. What's the difference between this? And I would say the key difference is actually the web. The web let us scale computation. And so lots of people are hard on the web and say, oh my God, what is this technology? It's all gross, it's all messy, it's all this. I won't argue with that. I mean, there's a lot of really, you look at this and you go like, oh my God, let me fix it. One thing I hope you get out of this class is that you give up on that idea of fixing it. Because it was never designed. It evolved. Like JavaScript. JavaScript has some blemishes that are just like, oh my God, why can't someone fix that? That is so ugly. Well, the problem is that JavaScript runs on like a billion devices. If I change the language, how long will it take me to update all those billion devices? The answer is infinity. It's not happening. You're stuck with it. It happened to be in the right place at the right time. When Netscape needed a programming language, they made JavaScript, it got deployed, it got accepted, and now we're all stuck with it. I think it's got some good features, but it has some bad things too, but we're still stuck with the good and the bad. And that's true for most of the web stack. It's just there. Some layers you just gotta live with. You can try adding on top of it, you can put it in boiler, you can try compensating for it, but you're not gonna replace it. So hopefully you'll learn web development is a process of coping, not fixing. But then, when I say the web is what allowed us to scale. That's how we got these large systems. We have Google scale systems because of the web. By the way, do people know why Google needs so many computers? Like, fundamentally, it's one big thing. They mirror the web. They have a copy of the entire publicly accessible, indexable web on their systems. They download it all and keep it. Some multiple copies. You should think about that for a second. Go like, oh my God, that's a lot of stuff. So that way, Google has grown literally with the web. It used to be you could store the entire web on like 5-10 computers. Now, in a couple million. So the natural thing to ask is, what is it about the web? What was right? Some decisions were wrong with the web, but some decisions were right. What were the right decisions? What was it about the design of this technology that made it so scalable, that allowed you to do all this stuff? And there were, I believe a key design decision was made very, very early on. There are a couple of them, but I think there's one in particular that no one else had done.
key design decision of the web, which is, I think, the best decision that was ever made and a complete curse to everything web related, which is that web servers are traditionally stateless. Yeah. You might go, wait a second, I log into the web all the time. I'm like, you know, I'm have my session in my browser and stuff like that. It's all a hack. It's all on top of this basic idea of statelessness in web browsers. And you might go like, well, why don't we get rid of the statelessness then if you have to compensate for it with all these hacks? But this is what lets the web scale. The reason why this lets the web scale is because stateless servers implies replicated servers. You have your server and it's dealing with some, you know, some number of connections per second, and you go like, oh no, I have now many more people trying to access it. What do? You add more servers. And they run in parallel. And you just say, oh, you get half the request, you get half the request. So you get a quarter, you get a quarter. You just spread it around. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't even matter if one request goes to server A and the next request goes to server B and the third request goes to server C, all from the same machine. In a given session, when you talk to Google, you don't know how many servers you're talking to. You could talk to many different ones. Now, actually, I think probably even with the HTTPS stuff, I don't know exactly how they do that stuff. But even it's all, you can replicate things because it's stateless. And you might say, well, then how, but there's state. Things are remembered. It knows that I've logged in. Well, it does. But that's because you identify yourself. When you send a request to a web server, you tell it who you are. Now that, right there, should go, that's kind of bad. Because that's also the source of all the privacy issues with the web. Is that every time you connect to a web server, you tell the web server who you are. And that used, you know, first, probably like, are you logged in? But you don't just tell one server. If you, so as you go through this course, you will see how complex a modern web page is. So if you go to any major news site or any like Reddit or Slashdot or whatever, you look at all the servers that are talked to by that connection. And you realize that you're not talking to one server. You're talking to like 20 at least. You aren't just telling one person about you browsing the web. You're telling the whole world. But this all works because of the statelessness. Because the ad servers and everything also can scale because you identify yourself on every connection. So this stateless service is an idea that's built into the HTTP protocol. HTTP and HTML, very closely related things. What's the difference between them? Yes. Protocol, language. What's that mean? You see a protocol in a language. I mean, in some, if you step back for a second, that differentiation between protocol and language is actually kind of bizarre. Computer science really has messed up these terms because a protocol is a way of communication. A language is a way of communication. So I've just said language, language. But they are kind of different. So what is this?
HTTP is how you send stuff, and HTML is how you show stuff.
Yes. Send and receive, show. This is hypertext transport protocol, hypertext markup language. HTML is a derivative of this thing called SGML, standard generalized markup language. SGML was created by a committee. This is very large and unwieldy. Tim Berners-Lee looked at this and said, oh my God, I can't implement all this. So he just created his own thing that looked kind of like HTML, but simplified and called it HTML and used that for building, you know, the first web browsers. And then later on, people went like, oh, wow, some of those ideas in HTML are kind of interesting and maybe we can incorporate them. And so we'll make something called XML. Then once they started using XML, they said, oh, that's really good for programs to talk to each other. Oh, but it's kind of verbose and messy and I don't like it and stuff. And it can't be used in all the ways I want it to, so we'll use JSON. Now, what the real XML is kind of verbose and messy and stuff. And things. There are reasons not to like it, but the real reason JSON has become most popular is because it bypasses certain key browser security mechanisms. That should also make you go like, what? The story of computer security is regular programmers and stuff say, oh, wouldn't it be nice to build this? And they go off and build it, and the security people go like, oh, that was a bad idea. I'm going to hack your system. And then they go, okay, we're going to stop doing that. We're going to limit it and stuff like that. And they go, oh, but I want to do this. And they start building again. They go, security, no, you shouldn't do that. So, security people are the real downers of the computers of the computer industry. They just keep telling you, you can't do that. That's a bad idea. But somehow, even people work around them. You know what a firewall does? It blocks certain kinds of protocols. Do you know what we did after firewalls came along? We figured out a way to do everything that we were doing before, but do it on protocols that go through firewalls. That's what some things like SOAP you might have heard. I don't know if any of you web tech. SOAP is basically exactly the same technology that was being used. Otherwise, it's something called RPC, Remote Procedure Calls. In other words, I want to make a program on one computer call code on another computer and have the result come back. RPCs are a fun programming abstraction. We will talk about RPC-like mechanisms in the course throughout this course. But RPC has this one major flaw. It's too easy. It means that you can expose your entire program to the entire world. And you get things like, oh, I can make a window pop up on your desktop from anywhere in the world. Older versions of Windows had a Win pop-up service running by default, listening to the network. And so it used to be you could just send a packet to a Windows box and a window would pop up. It's like, now you've lived in the web, like, that's a dumb idea. And so when you talk about your application level firewall, like you're about to enable that firewall is just there to block all the stupid programs that are still part of Windows from, and you add on from talking to the world. But then they figure out, well, now we've blocked off everything on the internet, what goes through? The web goes through. So let's do the same, let's do Win pop-ups through the web. That's today. So I'm almost out of time here. I just want to give a little preview of what we're going to do tomorrow in tutorial. So what you're going to do tomorrow in tutorial is you're going to go into lab. You're going to get the virtual machine running on your SCS account. If you do not have an SCS account that works on the Windows machines, you get one set up before you go to lab. Otherwise, you're going to sit there and spend half a lab trying to get an account working. That's always very sad. But you'll get your virtual machine running. You'll get a web application running in there. And you will start learning JavaScript. How am I going to have you first learn JavaScript? Anyone have an idea? It's called Code Academy. Any of you heard of Code Academy? Go to Code Academy. Go through the lessons on JavaScript and basic web stuff. Just go through it. Because really, I'm going to kind of assume that you've learned that stuff. And I will cover some of it, but just go through Code Academy if you want to start early. Because that stuff is just the bare level stuff, and you need to be learning stuff above that as this course goes on. Yes? The course is the tutorials, the assignments, and the midterm final. Everything else supports that. There are no slides. There are no lecture slides. I will suggest readings, but really it's about learn that. Okay, thank you.